9 at Radio Free America, and this is Uncle Sam with music and the truth until dawn. Right now, I got a few words for some of our brothers and sisters in the occupied zone. The chair is against the wall. The chair is against the wall. John has a long mustache. John has a long mustache. It's 12 o'clock, Americans, another day closer to victory. And for all of you out there on or behind the lines, this is your song.
Now you cut that fence and get this platoon on the move!
Well, listen, you crummy, flat-footed copper. I'll show you whether I lost my nerve and my brains.
Man, we like to feel that we can get out of trouble quicker than we got into it.
I'm not fighting for anything anymore except myself. I'm the only cause I'm interested in.
Welcome, everyone, to the Mountain Pass Podcast. This is the Root Hog or Die episode. The date is June 21st, 2021, the longest day. And I'm smoking my pipe, coming to you from my fortress in the heart of Cascadia. Just trying to get my pipe going. I was initially planning to actually go on a hike today. Hike up and camp out on one of the mountain ridges that probably wouldn't be too much of a hike and just sit and watch the sunset. But I decided not to. There's just too much stuff for me to do around the house. My garden, the weeds grow overnight. So it is a day-to-day battle. And just there was other stuff. I'd just gotten back home from a weekend, the Father's Day weekend stuff. So just did not. Whenever you're doing something overnight, you got to deal with the logistical stuff. So I did not end up doing that. Well, we've got a good episode to do this week. Just bear with me while I'm smoking. All right. So I guess we'll start with the first thing is I've been doing something new on my website. It's called I'll Be Brief, and it's based off of a kind of a running joke with my buddies where I used to say I'll be brief, and then I started to go on a tangent, a soliloquy, a rambling that was anything but brief. And I was trying to solve two problems at the same time. I was trying to figure out a way to write some short stuff, but I was also wanting to start generating more content on my website. I want to start driving traffic to the website, mainly just so that I can be in control of my audience. I want I want my audience to come to my website, not to someone else's website that they can say, oh, we're not continuing your search. We've locked you out of your account. I mean, the lesson learned is you never rely on your enemy to, you know, make your bread. No, yes, I have my books on Amazon, but I can easily just put them on something else. I would easily just go grab everything I needed and put it on another site. But I also just wanted to start blogging again. There's just stuff that I wanted to say and wanted to talk about, and there's not really some of the stuff I can talk about on this podcast, but sometimes I just want to write stuff. I just want to get, it helps me keep, it's almost like a journal that allows me to write about stuff or talk about stuff later on the podcast. So you can go to the website, tjmartinell.com, and just check out the I'll Be Brief stuff, because they're going to have their own category. I just put up one today. One's coming out tomorrow. So I've got a cloud of tobacco smoke right in front of me, and it looks like some like racing horse. It's kind of crazy. It's crazy. Wow. It's like levitating. Kind of like that scene from Lord of the Rings. I'm sure some of you were thinking about it. So I've been reading this book about Jedediah Smith, who was a mountain man, and every book I've ever read regarding Jedediah Smith has involved at some point discussions about Hugh Glass. Hugh Glass was a a trapper and mountain man who was the topic or the center protagonist in the film The Revenant, which came out a couple years ago. And I mean, I enjoyed the film Revenant. I thought it was, I liked a lot of it. There was a lot of stuff though I didn't like, to be honest. And one of the things I didn't like about the movie is stuff I later read about regarding what actually transpired. And you're obviously wondering, well, what was it that was kind of the letdown? It's how the film ended. So this film came out years ago. If you haven't watched it, you know, and you don't want spoilers, then just skip this part of the podcast or don't download it. We all have choices to make in life. You chose not to watch The Revenant at this point, so I'm choosing to not be sympathetic to your tardiness. At the end of the film, so in this film, Hugh Glass is wounded. He's mauled by a bear. Everyone assumes he's going to die, so they pay these two guys, Fitzgerald and Jim Bridger, who I also have a biography on. They pay him to just stay with him until he dies and then bury him, or if he recovers, to bring him back. At some point, they decide to abandon him. They either assume he's dead or whatever it was, but they take his stuff. They take all of his stuff for the most part. So in the film, Hugh Glass comes all the way back to where they're at, and he wants revenge on Fitzgerald, not Jim Bridger, because in the film, Fitzgerald kills Hugh Glass's son, says he ran off, and they got to get out of there because the Indians are coming, and that, you know, Fitzgerald was, or Hugh Glass was dead. So Jim Bridger thought he was dead. In real life, that's not necessarily what happened. We don't know because we only have so many accounts. We don't have a reliable record of what actually transpired. What we do know is that Hugh Glass did make it back, but nobody died. Like in the film, all these people, I mean, yes, people died at the beginning of both the story in real life and in the film, but no, like Fitzgerald does not die in real life. And rather than being sympathetic to Jim Bridger, Hugh Glass is actually chastising him. So there's this passage I want to read. This is from the book, Jedediah Smith and the Opening of the West. This is when he's confronting Jim Bridger. So according to the book, one of the early chroniclers who insists that a passion for revenge sustained Glass through all these adventures gives the scene a fitting climax. With dignity and severity, he says, but with great feeling, Glass addressed the stricken youth. He's referring to Jim Bridger. Young man, it is Glass that is before you, the same that not content with leaving, you thought to a cruel death upon the prairie you robbed, helpless as he was, of his rifle, his knife, of all, with which he could hope to defend or save himself. I swore an oath that I would be revenged on you and the wretch who is with you, and I ever thought to have kept it. For this meeting, I have braved the dangers of a long journey, but I cannot take your life. You have nothing to fear from me. Go, you are free. For your youth, I forgive you. Let's assume that that's what he actually said to Jim Bridger. Jim Bridger was probably in his late teens. I mean, we can only imagine how much Hugh Glass thought of getting revenge, but then he probably came and saw Jim Bridger face to face, and Jim Bridger looked at a man that he thought had died, probably, or that he was young and scared. Whatever it was, Hugh Glass realized that this boy was not really responsible for what had happened, that it was would have been unjust of him to have held him to the same expectation as you would a man. Or maybe Hugh Glass was looking at his own youth and said, would I have done any differently? And the answer probably would have been no. He would have done the exact same thing. And I know nothing about Hugh Glass's childhood. I know nothing about his background. I can only imagine that if he would have only been able to kill Bridger if he felt like he himself would have done the right thing, or, you know, in his mind, the right thing, and stuck around. And he just felt like that, whatever reason, he understood that he could not hold him to the same standards as Fitzgerald. So here's the passage where he finds Fitzgerald. So he goes to kill Fitzgerald, right? This is a guy he sees as a coward, a derelict, a deserter, someone who abandons his comrade. And he finds out that Fitzgerald had enlisted as a private in the 6th Infantry. So he's essentially protected from revenge. So this is according to one of the chroniclers. His name is George Yunt, but this is in the biography I was reading. He says, Glass found the recreant individual who had so cruelly deserted him when he lay helpless and torn so shockingly by the grizzly bear. He also there recovered his favorite rifle. To the man, he only addressed him as he did to the boy. Go, false man, and answer to your own conscience and to your God. I have suffered enough in all reason by your perfidy. You was well paid to have remained with me until I should be able to walk. You promised to do so, or to wait my death and decently bury my remains. I heard the bargain. Your shameful perfidy and heartless cruelty, but enough, again I say, settle the matter with your own conscience and your God. There was another sentence I wanted to throw out there that I thought was good. I underlined it. In no man has the will to live ever burned more fiercely. And he's referring to Hugh Glass. And he's actually reflecting on Jim Bridger, the person who's writing the biography. And he said, all that can be said is that Bridger, in after years, had a blameless reputation among the mountain men. And if in his youth he had made a mistake, it was not held against him. So I thought that was actually been a much better way. Like, sticking with the actual historical record would have been more interesting of a story than for them to change it so that, you know, the way they did. Because that one has a bit of a Shakespearean poetic sense of I guess, satisfaction. And irony. You know, he comes to find the young Jim Bridger and just takes pity on him. His what drove him to live was revenge, and now he realizes he's not going to take revenge. And then he meets with Fitzgerald, this guy who's a complete coward, and he's in the military. You can imagine how Glass would have felt to see a guy that he considers to be a coward wearing a soldier's uniform. But this is once again an example of where a film takes historical license in ways that I think are either gratuitous or just unnecessary. There was no reason for them to change that. And even the words, according to what the chronicler said, this is what Shakespeare might have had them say. Oh, I totally forgot to mention. Speaking of the website stuff. I also just discovered that I can upload my podcast directly to my website. I had tried doing that actually before signing up for SoundCloud, but I thought that you had to like sign up for some greater premium service or something like that would have been more pricey. I think someone also said it's easy, like you're getting exposure for your podcast is easier, but we're actually going to be uploading the podcast directly to the website because I paid for SoundCloud. I will not be using them moving forward. It's going to be on my website. Because again, if people want to listen to my podcast, they're going to have to go to my website and they're going to have to download it from my website. And somebody can't take away my ability to provide my podcast to my audience, however big and however small it is. So let's go with the, let's start with the topic of this episode, the root hog or die concept. This was something I was reading about in the biography of Davy Crockett. I did an episode on that a couple weeks ago. And this term root hog or die refers to, it was a kind of a motto that these mountain men, will people, frontiersmen had, and the background was that a lot of people raised wild hogs, or they raised hogs, but they didn't actually feed them. They would send them out into the wilderness and in the frontier land to basically fend for themselves. And the idea was that the hogs were going to go get their own food or they were going to die. So in the same way, people have to root hog or die. In other words, basically figure out how to take care of themselves. And that's kind of how it is now in a lot of cases. You're going to have to learn, a lot of people are in denial about this, but you're going to have to take care of yourself. Like, you are your own responsibility. No one is looking out for you. And I don't say that in a, you don't deserve to be looked out for. It's just the support system doesn't exist anymore. Okay, this pipe is being atrocious. I'm going to get another one. It's just not giving me the... not giving me the smoke I want. Right, we'll just stick with that for now. I just want to get the light going. There we go. I guess the takeaway from that is you gotta look out for your own needs and your own life. You can't look around for someone else to for someone else to solve your problems. Kind of like that line from Shawshank Redemption, you know, get busy living or get busy dying. Now, you're not in the wilderness, obviously, for the most of you, I'm assuming. But it's a different kind of wilderness today. Like, what made it the wilderness? It was just the lack of infrastructure, the lack of support system. I mean, that's what made it the frontier. No civilization. Well, if you look at some downtown city, the downtowns of some cities, there's no civilization there either. There's infrastructure, it's crumbling. But no, like, nobody is coming. So my whole thought is that that's kind of one of my mottos now is get, you know, root hog or die. And ultimately you're going to have to make decisions for your own life. You're going to have to make choices and accept the consequences or then reap the rewards as they may be. And things are so kind of chaotic culturally, socially, politically, economically, that your circumstances may be totally different from someone else's. So they may have done something that worked out for them, but it's not replicable. And it's not so much knowing what to do in specific specific situations, it's about having a general principle or attitude or mindset. When a crisis occurs, there's two different kinds of people. There's people who look around and say, who's going to save us? And then there's people who look around and say, I need to save myself. And I don't mean in like a theological, existential, spiritual sense. I'm talking about saving like literally bodily life or death. Okay, this pipe is doing awful too. Maybe it's the tobacco. I don't know. It's having a problem. That's one of the things I liked about guys like Davy Crockett and these mountain men. They weren't looking around for someone else to have the answers for their life questions. You know, they were not going to some guy online with consulting questions. Expecting someone to have all the answers to everything in life and just hand it to them without having to do any of the work. Like, you are going to have to do the work. And it's not a chastisement for towards people, but just saying it's giving them a realization. You, in order to get the answers, you're going to have to do the work yourself. You're going to have to do the homework. You're going to have to do the legwork. You're going to have to weigh the pros and cons. And more importantly, you're going to have to make the decision because you're the one who's going to live with the consequences. Someone else can give you all the advice that they want. They can give you all the counsel, guidance. They can tell you, you should do this, you should do that, you should totally do this, this will totally work out. But the question you have to ask yourself is, if it doesn't work out for me, who's going to pay the price? Like this goes back to the issue that they don't have skin in the game. If somebody doesn't have skin in the game, if somebody's giving you advice and the consequences are not going to be borne by them, they're not going to have to deal with it. They're not going to feel guilty about it or even take responsibility for the fact that they made an error in giving you that advice. And instead, they just rationalize why it didn't work out for some other reason. Like, it could have worked out if you'd just done it differently. That's advice that you ignore. And this is not pessimism. It's just, this is almost an entirely separate topic, but people who want to live in a world where they never want to hear anything negative, that we're positive people. We only have positive thoughts. Well, if someone's got hit by a car in front of you and they're dying and need medical aid, is it pessimistic or negative thinking or giving negative thoughts for someone to say they're dying, somebody hit them with their car, we need to call an ambulance? Or are you complaining? No, you're saying there is a problem, we need to get it solved. Or when your house, like, you know, someone comes to your house and says, oh, someone's a mechanic or a plumber is like, yeah, you got this problem with your plumbing. You got this problem with your central heating unit. Your roof needs repair. Like, these are all things that have negative consequences. Mainly, you have to spend money. But does that mean like we don't want to hear it? I mean, the positive thinking thing is mainly I want to stick my hand in the sand and let someone else deal with the realities of the world. Now, you can maintain a optimistic or positive mindset, but you are going to, that's different from avoiding conflict. That's different from avoiding confrontation. That's different from avoiding hardship or challenges or overcoming adversity and persevering through stuff and enduring and feeling pain. That's very different. But I think we've gotten to a point where we've ignored or repressed so much stuff that to merely acknowledge it triggers people because they've spent their entire lives pretending and trying to deceive themselves into thinking that things aren't going on that are going on. And they've been able to avoid that because it doesn't directly affect them. You know, if you're an older person, you've been able to basically ride the stock market. I mean, think if you put money in the stock market back in 1980. You threw money into that thing over the years. I mean, you couldn't have lost. If you just stuck money in the stock market, for the most part, and you just let go of it and didn't look back, you made money. If you bought a house in 1980 and you just held on to it, you have acquired equity in your house, guaranteed. So it's easy for that kind of a person to just pretend like stuff that's going on in the economy. And then also they've worked the same job for 30 years and they reached a level of rank in the pecking order where they're never going to have to worry about getting fired or laid off, or they're at some job where it's not going to get shipped overseas and it's not going to get they're not going to get replaced by some H-1B worker from India or something like that. I mean, someone who's able to just avoid realities of life. And then, of course, then their son or daughter is dealing with the total lack of savings rates at banks. CDs don't mean anything anymore. You got to constantly play the stock market roller coaster. You got people investing in cryptocurrency. You got people, they can't afford a home. Their jobs are all, you know, gig economy, so they don't have benefits. They're having to deal with all that other stuff. Like, that is a person who can't ignore reality, because reality, the negative consequences are in their reality. So when I talk about these things of root hog or die, you've got to look out for yourself. And I point out that institutions do not have your back in most, if that's the exception. I'm not saying you avoid, if someone's like, hey, we'd like to help you get to where you want to be, great, take advantage of it, but don't expect it. Just don't expect to get the kind of help that, it's interesting that we always hear about how, you know, nobody owes you anything and you're not entitled to anything. This is said by the same people where I turn on the TV at the weight room and there's some, you know, former boxing weight champion or some actor talking about how they should call and find out to get the Medicaid benefits that you're entitled to. I mean, I don't want to ever hear about how no one is entitled to anything. Really? Explain Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare. Explain welfare. People clearly, some people are, they're not rightfully entitled, but they do get entitlements. This is about having realistic expectations that you are not disappointed. The better your expectations are in life, the more accurate they are to real life, the less disappointed you're going to be, the less heartache and hardship you're going to have, and the better you're going to be able to make good life decisions that will benefit you in the long run. And sometimes that's not possible, but better to have made a mistake that you made than to have made a mistake that somebody else told you to make. And someone could, of course, say, hey, if you just listened to me and done what I said, you would have been doing just fine and you would be better here. And it's like, you know what? That may be true, but in over the long term, in the grand scheme of things, it's always better to make your decisions, even if sometimes they're not the best ones. You don't get to go, you know, delegate your moral agency as a human being to another person because they make better life decisions than you. Well, I actually, when I hear that, I'm thinking, well, in some cases, yeah, actually, now that I think about it, I'm talking more of like where you make a decision that someone else, you know, advised you on, but then you don't take responsibility when there's consequences. Like if you've given up authority in a meaningful manner, you know, like you've signed some sort of official document on some issue like power of attorney or whatever. Okay, that's one thing. I'm talking where you're deciding where to move, whether to take a job or not, whether to buy a house in this neighborhood or not. you don't get to say, well, they got to make the choice for me. No, you didn't sign over your moral agency. You didn't sign anything over formally or legally. You signed it over in your head. Ah, sorry, I've got a really sore tricep. I've been doing bench press for the first time in a long couple of years. Not doing too bad. Not doing too bad. If I don't, God, I should have, I stretched. I should have just taken it easy, but I couldn't because I just can't help it. I've talked before about the internet and how the internet has done some good stuff and done some bad stuff. One of the things that it's done is it's allowed weak people to control strong people. You can have a complete fat dork slob of a loser who's good at computers who can basically control people who are much physically stronger than them, people who would dominate them in a more of a old-fashioned world. And especially with these COVID lockdowns, it was weak people controlling the strong. I recently realized something else. The internet has empowered losers and weirdos and the mentally ill and the psychos. I'm guessing a lot of you are not going to ask what I mean because you know exactly what I'm talking about. You want to talk about any topic out there, you're going to have some fanatic. You're going to have some weirdo. You're going to have some guy who's obsessed. And he's going to want to just spurg out on anyone who wants to talk about that stuff. But moreover, one of the things about losers is they know that they're losers. They know that they're at the bottom of the social hierarchy. And they seethe with resentment, envy, bitterness, and all that other stuff. So what they do is the internet allows them to interfere with normal men's... I'm going to talk about men because with women, it's different. Yes, it's different. I know. We're shocked. We're shocked. We're all shocked. When men are trying to organize or collaborate or interact... And these are men who are kind of a higher social status. The spurs and losers show up and immediately try to interfere with it. They'll do that by, you know, throwing basically a bomb in the room by getting, you know, inflammatory rhetoric. They'll be disingenuous in their discussions and arguments. They'll try to interfere with the ability of two people to communicate. They'll you know... create discord and I'm not talking about the gaming site, like communication site. I'm talking about they're going to try and break up the group. When they see a bunch of healthy guys getting together to have discussions, they want to come in and destroy it because back in the day, they couldn't do that because it was all in real life. It was in person. And people knew who they were. It's like, yeah, that's the dork, dweeb, nerdy loser at the high school. He's not going to be able to get to pitch get the football player and the soccer player and the baseball player to fight over something stupid. Because online, a loser can pretend to be something other than a loser, even though if you're you know what a loser looks like and how they behave, and you understand the loser mindset. You're able to pick them out pretty quickly. But they tend to be fairly good at hiding their true intent until later. And the other problem is people not looking for that, not realizing that that's the end game. They take the bait. When a debate starts, when they bring up conflict, when they stir up conflict and division, and feuds, people take the bait rather than saying, oh, this guy's trying to divide us and pit us against each other. He's got to go. You just get rid of him. Like, thou shalt not suffer losers. That's like that has to be a commandment. But it's easier now for losers with just a computer or a laptop or their smartphone. They can locate men who are trying to interact. Let's say on Twitter, you know, we're having a great conversation about something, and then somebody goes in and they look at their profiles. It's like, okay, this guy's a conservative Christian. The other guy's whatever. And they're having a discussion about something. And you know that if you just bring up a topic that you know they're going to disagree on, you can get them to start fighting each other instead of actually having a thoughtful interaction. Right? I mean, public discussions on social media are dominated by the extremes. The extremes set the tone and narrative. They get to decide what the overt window is. Like what is the belief of one side? Well, it's always the extremes. There's no nuance allowed. It kind of reminds me of this joke somebody told me when I was younger. They said, you know, TJ, back in the day, if you wanted to stalk somebody, you couldn't be lazy. Like, the internet has made stalking a lazy man's pursuit, because all you got to do is just use Google. Back in the day, you had to actually go to the phone book and you got to go look at the address, and then you had to go look it up on a map and actually drive there. And, you know, I'm not saying he did this. He was kind of joking. He was a funny guy. Funny guy. But his point was that the internet has made things easy that used to be hard, so that it kept out, like, this is the thing about losers. They are lazy. So back in the day, a lazy loser couldn't do much. They just, for them to cause that much trouble would have just taken too much work. Now they can just basically sit there all day and just cause trouble. It doesn't require any effort on their part. So my conclusion a lot of times is once men meet like-minded men who would interact well, you take that stuff private. The only way to protect yourself from the losers is to go private. Now, what that looks like, I don't know. I don't know if that's the direction we're going to see the internet going. It's possible things are going to just get worse, where it's going to become even more atomized. People are going to become more and more hyper-individualistic. They're not going to have any kind of meaningful friendship. Who knows? I don't know. Or things could take a completely different turn. That's another possibility. Regardless, this I know, the internet has empowered losers. That is a fact. That's science. So I guess I'll end on this discussion. It'll be the last topic for this evening. I saw this blog post. It was discussing whether men should pursue women or whether women should pursue men. And for kind of the context, it was looking at it from a religious, a Christian biblical perspective. But I think my answer can kind of have has application in either context. So they're giving examples from the Bible, which it's like, okay, not applicable, because there was no dating back then. Like, I think this is one of the problems when you're trying to, like, oh, what does it say in the Bible? Well, there was no dating in the Bible. You had women didn't get to really choose. I mean, it's not like they were forced to marry men they didn't want to marry necessarily, depending on what society you were talking about in question. But like it wasn't like the woman was out in the world on her own, outside of her, you know, detached from her family in some strange town, working for an employer. Unmarried women were basically with their families until they got married. So there was no dating as we know it today. I just think it's really funny that people are trying to it's like saying, well, how do we use our telephone? How do we fix our smartphone? I don't know. What's in the Bible? Like, you know, it's not a technical manual. Right? It doesn't have a chapter on how to invest your 401k. Like, that's, you know, you go to other books for that. And when you talk about dating or trying to get married, that's not a book that tells you how to do it. Like, this is one of the problems with, we could go on a whole other thing on this. I've already been working on notes for this podcast. It's coming. I just need to get in the mood to do it. But one of the things that is noticeable about a lot of Christian men and women is they look at the Bible as a literal how-to guide for life in terms of actual, like, specific stuff. Like, there's things there that are just not, I'm not talking about the morality per se. I'm saying if you're trying to figure out how to navigate the dating world today, that is not going to tell you practical stuff. It's going to tell you moral stuff and ethical stuff, but it's not going to tell you how to do it. Like, there's some good verses on homes and having a house and having family. It doesn't tell you how to build a house. It doesn't give you advice or counsel or recommendations on what to look for in a house. It doesn't tell you how, like, what's the best financial plan. Like, this is why you have financial planners and you have mortgage lenders and you have all this other stuff, which we shouldn't have because I don't think we should be using charging with interest. That's a whole other podcast topic. We should not be, we're a debtor nation as a result. It's bad. We should have learned our lesson from the medieval times. But anyways, the Bible is not going to teach you how to do that. You know, the Bible is not going to teach me how to maintain my garden and use the tools that I use. It's not going to tell me how to differentiate the tomatoes that I'm trying to grow this year from the tomatoes that I grew last year, which are a different type. It doesn't tell me how to differentiate between the different herbs that I've grown. Like, that's, I need to go look into another book that specifically deals with that topic. Like, there are parables about gardeners and there's discussions about gardens. That's not why they're talking about them. So when people are trying to have a conversation about whether men should pursue women or women pursue men, they're reading a book in which women were not allowed to make those decisions. Men went and asked the father for permission because the father still had authority over the daughter. This was a genuine, literal patriarchal environment. This was not 2021. Right? There was no dating app for people who lived in the desert. You know? Instead of Bumble, you have Bedouin, you know? But I was thinking about this topic, and I was like, okay, you know, they're both making their points, and I think that we're kind of, we've created the worst of both worlds. The outcome right now has been the worst of both worlds, where men are not pursuing when they should, and women are not pursuing when they should. I think the issue isn't whether they're pursuing, it's how you're pursuing, right? Men should be masculine, women should be feminine. We've gone over this many times in the past. And so men and women express themselves in masculine and feminine ways. They're different, and they can express the exact same emotions, the same feelings and affections, the same thoughts. They just express them in ways that are appropriate for their, for whether they're a man or a woman. And so the way that a man asserts himself in a masculine way when it comes to women is by being assertive and confident and not domineering, but he's being dominant. He is leading in terms of essentially taking responsibility and authority in the interaction. So that's an example of a man asserting himself in a masculine way and pursuing a woman in a masculine way, where he goes up and is saying how, you know, for lack of a better way of saying this, I don't really quite know how to articulate, but, you know, let's say he sees a girl that he likes. He goes up to her and he introduces himself and he says, I want to see you, or I want to get a drink with you, or, and he says he makes a plan. For those of you who've seen Tommy Learns video, you'll like, you make a plan. You say, yes, we're going to hang out on Friday at 5:30 at this bar, and you've made a plan, right? You are making the decisions and asserting yourself. Well, then, of course, someone's going to say, well, what does the feminine way look like? Well, I'm saying this from a male perspective, so caveat there. I'm acknowledging that there are limitations on my understanding. As hard as it may be for some people to believe, there are some limitations on my understanding of how of the female mind. Well, I can tell you from a man's perspective what we find attractive in being pursued by a woman and what we find unattractive. What is unattractive is when women try to pursue men as though they are the man. So a woman comes up to me and says, hey, we're hanging out, and we're hanging out at this time, at this place, on this day. My response would be, no, we're not. Says, we're actually going to hang out when I say we're going to hang out, and I get to make the decision of whether we're going to hang out. She can pursue by being subtle and discreet, but nevertheless unmistakably clear that she is interested. Right? Where if a girl is giving you looks of interest, or she's being flirtatious, like, you know, let's say I'll give hypothetical, guys, I don't give a lot of real life examples just to avoid Spurgs reading too much, but let's say I'm reading a book and this girl comes up to me and she asks about the book, and I'm talking to her about the book or something like that, and then we engage in a bunch of playful banter, right? She came up to me, asked about the book, started the conversation, and she's engaging in playful banter, but she is not giving orders. She is not taking charge or leading, because she's waiting for me to do that as the man, as I'm supposed to do. And I know that there are some people out there who say, well, why can't the women assert themselves? And I know some men who would argue about that. And my response to that is, man, you got to do that is what men say when they don't want to do the work. They don't want to take the risk. They don't want to make the decisions. They don't want to assert themselves. They don't want to be dominant, because that means that they have to actually be awake and alert and be, you know, just not like, can't just be doing, yes, honey, yes, dear, whatever you say, dear, you know, I was talking about this with my buddy Vince. We were hanging out over in Kansas City. And it occurred to me, I was like, because he was just telling me about, you know, when you're when you're a man and you're being assertive in the relationship, it's a lot of work because you're making a lot of the decisions. And I said, yeah, that's probably one of the reasons why a lot of men are content with having a quote unquote equal partnership, where the wife ends up, or girlfriend ends up, making all the decisions, because he just doesn't want to do it and he's lazy and it frustrates her. But at the same time, she can't complain about it. She can't insist that he be more assertive, because that would betray the equal partnership. Honey, I'm supportive of gender equality, right? What is she going to say to that? I mean, either that, or she's going to just say, yeah, that's all a bunch of nonsense. I can't believe you fell for that. Man up and start making some decisions, starting where are we going to go get a drink tonight? I guess, like, a girl, like a girl being tactfully flirtatious and giving a lot of nonverbal cues of, I want you to pursue me, or I want you to be, you know, like, approach me, or all that kind of stuff. That's them pursuing in a feminine way, because they are inviting. And they're doing it in a very artful way. This goes back to the podcast I did about how rhetoric and playful banter is a form of verbal dancing. So the way a woman dances in an actual dance is very different from the way the man dances. The man who is leading, as between the two, his dancing is just distinctly different than the way a woman does in a dance. And so they're both dancing, but they are dancing differently because they have different roles in that. So yes, women can pursue men if they want to. You just need to do it in a way that is going to allow the man to be masculine in how he responds. Because if you go up to him and say, if you know, essentially, you're the one introducing yourself, you're asking him questions, and then you're saying, we need to hang out, you're not allowing him to lead. And so, what's wrong with that? Well, go look at the divorce rates. What's wrong with charging over no man's land? I don't know. Look at the casualty rates. So that is all I've got for this podcast, right? If you're a lady, you're single, you're interested in a guy, do not go up to him and be like direct. You need to be subtle. And if he's not picking up on the cues, then there's something wrong with him and you're better off not dealing with him. And gentlemen, you need to go directly approach a girl you're interested in. Don't be passive aggressive or indirect. And you need to state, you know, not state your intentions like an autistic spurg, but just assert yourself. And yes, for a lot of you guys, it's scary and you get nervous and you're afraid of rejection. You're afraid of how they're going to respond, or you're afraid of making a fool of yourself. Yes, that is called, that's a natural reason to be nervous, but you do it anyways because you need to have courage, because you're a man and men need to be brave. They need to be brave in how they pursue, because their pursuit of a woman creates a context in which the man, I'm using a lot of these words, application context, yeah, I get it. A woman can pursue a man in a way where she's never going to get, this is another reason why, the difference. Women need to pursue in a way where they're not going to get overtly rejected and they can save face. A lot of guys, in a lot of cases, we need to pursue in a way where we're going to get, the rejection is going to be direct. We don't get to save face, so to speak. We have to accept the rejection, acknowledge it, not be a little sissy, and move on. So, all right, that is all I've got for this podcast. Thank you for listening. If you would like to read my books but haven't, you can go to my website. It will have the links to everything I need, everything you will ever need in life. If you buy the Kindle versions of all but The Pilgrim's Digress, if you buy my books that I self-published, you buy the physical copy, you get the Kindle version for free. So I want everyone to have a backup copy. And when you read the books, please leave a review. I need to get more. We need to start generating more reviews for my books. We need to start picking things up to go, you know, root hog or die, right? Leave a review or die. So once again, thank you for listening to this Mountain Pass podcast episode. This is your host, TJ Martinell, coming to you from my fortress in the heart of Cascadia, signing off.